Welcome to Forecasting Innovation. EUMETSAT is Europe's operational satellite agency for monitoring weather, climate and the environment from space. I'm Christina Bonanati, I'm an earth scientist and science communicator. Together with EUMETSAT's chief scientist Paolo Ruti, in this podcast series, we explore the frontiers of technology in satellite operations and weather science. We look forward to valuable insights, horizon-scanning outlooks, and thought-provoking discussions with scientists who are driving innovation and advancements. In this episode of Forecasting Innovation, we will explore how weather and Earth observation systems can stay relevant in a fast-changing world. From the stepwise progress of the past to the AI-driven disruption of today, and how foresight helps prepare for the next generation of observing networks. A special guest today, we would like to welcome Jonathan Taylor. He is Principal Fellow Observations at the UK Met Office. So welcome, Jonathan, and welcome, Paolo.
Welcome, and thanks, Jonathan, for being online today with us. That's a great opportunity.
It's my pleasure.
We have been working in the last few years on how observations are evolving in terms of needs, but also how the different prediction systems, but also the way this information is used into our community and different value chains, weather, climate, etc. I think it's extremely valuable to have this discussion, and it's been great to have Jonathan involved on this, and thanks also to UK Met Office for this opportunity.
It's been great. No, it's really exciting times, and looking forward to having a good discussion.
Just to set a little bit the framework of where we are living today, we need to jump back in the past a little bit. We need to go back to a period where both of us were probably in a different path of our career. And if I see back on the beginning of the year 2000, I was probably mostly working on climate applications, on general circulation of the atmosphere from a scientific point of view. But what was happening here at EUMETSAT in that period was a lot of discussion and try to have this crystal ball on what would have been the future in 2020 or in 2025 as we are today. And in that moment, the people, they were trying to guess what would have been the evolution of a weather prediction system, not only weather prediction system. They already knew that climate, a series of applications in key sectors, aviation is one of those, but because historical is extremely important for weather prediction. And they were trying to guess this evolution. It was interesting time, I would say. And those people that's in that moment, they had, of course, maybe they were lucky enough to be in a moment where an incremental view of what was the future, what was ahead, was a good, very good guess. So the crystal ball was a bit, not easier, but in somehow it was evident that the people they were expecting increasing in resolution of the weather prediction, increasing of the data simulation capabilities and so forth. And this was a way to think incrementally the future. And that was the time where maybe complexity was starting to be seen because of new sectors coming into the landscape. I don't know where you were, Jonathan, beginning of the year 2000.
2000, God dear me. Making me feel how, reminding me how old I'm getting. 2000, I was working with in airborne research in 2000. We were just transitioning from using a Hercules aircraft to a jet aircraft, but fundamentally making observations to improve our understanding of the model. And we were really beginning to explore, you know, the use of some of the advanced sensors that we were going to see, like IASI on the METOP platform, which had launched in 2006. So we were flying interferometers on research aircraft. So we were seeing this kind of increase in data volumes and challenges around how we manage, you know, increasing data volumes. And I think we've just seen an explosion in that as we go on. But certainly some of the changes we're seeing now in terms of AI and that, we're just blindsided to that in 2000. I mean, as you say, it was, we had a perspective of these increased data volumes. We knew that we were driving are forecasting to higher and higher spatial resolutions. So we had some expectation of increased data from our supercomputers, and even then the realization that managing that data and getting the data and the observations in front of the operational meteorologist and their ability to be able to look at so many different observation sources and so many different outputs from the model was always a challenge. And I think that's what we've seen over since then, is that those problems just growing and growing.
You mentioned, of course, the growing of the complexity and our observations, they are getting more relevant. I think we can also try to say that maybe time to time, single events can change the way we consider relevant observations for the day-to-day applications. Because I think we need to lend to some practical problems in a way that the people that they listen to this podcast, they really understand. I have in mind one example that was even before, so it was much earlier, so it's probably at the beginning of the weather prediction modern era. If you think at the beginning, end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s, the main, if you are looking to aviation, the aviation sector, the main parameters or variables that were used was fog, winds, shear, turbulence, of course, thunderstorms, precipitation, all those variables that were well understood the relevance for en route, landing, or how to manage at the airport. But at certain point, actually on a precise day in June 1982, a Boeing 747 passed through Jakarta, and he entered an ash cloud from a recently eruption of a nearby volcano. I don't want to pronounce, because it would be very very inappropriate for the people listening what my pronunciation of that. But that single event in June 1982 changed the way we considered a new observation extremely relevant for the aviation sector. So I think in this historical perspective, I think there are a single point in our history where they changed the way we consider relevant observations for what we do. Yes, I can imagine that you probably had similar experience in your...
I mean, I think the 2010 eruption of Eyjafjallajökull out of Iceland was a kind of a very significant event, obviously global event, but particularly very challenging for the Met Office, and huge demands on observations and satellite data and our ability to provide a level of detail around ash concentrations that we would never expected to have to deliver. So that, I think that was a really changing time. I think for me, a more recent change, which I think brought home really how the way we gather observations is changing, was probably about 10 years ago when I was running the observations kind of capability at the Met Office. We were looking at our wind profiler network, and it was going to cost millions of pounds to refresh the infrastructure. Some really bright sparks in the team said, well, you know, why don't we do Mode S winds? You know, why don't we develop our own UK network of Mode S winds? And for those who don't know, Mode S is a communication system between commercial aircraft and navigation radars. And if you look at that data, which... It's just a communication system, but actually it's got useful meteorological information in there in terms of the effect of wind on aircraft direction and the difference between their GPS position and their compass heading. And suddenly, you know, by making that transition, we suddenly find ourselves bringing in, you know, millions of wind observations from commercial aircraft at a relatively low cost. So A, we've got this huge wealth of new data. And it's what we're calling an opportunistic data source, the first one that we really kind of brought into use. So that's a data source that's out there that wasn't designed for measuring the atmosphere, had a completely different function, but intrinsically has some atmospheric information in that data stream. And for me, that was a real eye-opener. And we decided to shut down our operational wind profiler network across the UK, save the money there, and switch to this operational source. And I think that was a real... kind of evidence of there's this sudden shift in how you can do things. We don't have to have traditional meteorological observing sites everywhere. We still need them. We still need those. But as our models demand more data at higher spatial and temporal resolutions, it's not always practical to go out and, you know, just put more and more weather stations, traditional weather stations out there. So for me, that was a real eye-opener in terms of that shift. Just, you know, the technology. I mean, when I first started as a research scientist at the Met Office, we had, you know, Meteosat 3 had been launched about three or four months earlier. In the UK, we'd had a 1987, October 87 storm, which was a very big forecast bust for us at the time. Studying that at university, I left university about a year later. And then this realization that actually we need to bring more satellite data in. And you compare that time to where we are now with the wealth of satellite data and observations, there's been a huge change. But it has been incremental.
This year, we launched the geostationary satellite with hyperspectral measurements. And these hyperspectral infrared measurements, they are able to slice the atmosphere and to determine temperature, for instance, profiles into the atmosphere. And as geostationary, it stays 36,000 kilometers and is in a specific orbit that rotates at the same angular velocity than the Earth. It's keeping looking to the same area, and which is Europe in our case, and of course Africa. And this is a tremendous, and of course it takes a few months to get the data to become operational, but that will be an incremental, incredible, important source of information. The atmosphere, which is a thin layer, you know, when the first astronauts was in space and was looking back to the Earth and looking to the horizon, you can see actually this thin layer of, I mean, in terms of density, what it matters is really the first 12, 15 kilometers. So it's very thin layers compared to the radius of the Earth. And these thin layers has extremely important properties, as the first one, which is the fact that it's rotating because the Earth is rotating, and it's stratified, which means that density, temperature, humidity, you have, and that creates a lot of, in our science, so storms, instabilities, and all. And these properties to look to the different layers of the atmosphere is incredibly important. And so this is, we have a first launch in June, end of June, with the new Metosat with the hyperspectral. And then we had later on a launch of the first polar system of the new generations, where we have, for instance, the microwave measurements, where that's also relevant to slice the atmosphere to get information. And this is where all those were conceived, designed 15, 20 years ago. And we see today the relevance. So you mentioned 1987, that was the critical moment in UK for the prediction. I think we need to restate that the amount of observations matters a lot for weather forecast as it is conceived today, as it is developed. It will increase its relevance in the future as we speak about weather prediction, even if we move to a full machine learning system, which is the novelty of the recent years, because observation will be critical for training and to provide initial information to those systems. So more observations we have, better prediction and better, let's say, preparedness and resilience of society for events that in the climate change context, events like the one in 1987 will increase.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, our whole business of forecasting is around initially understanding the initial system, understanding the structure of the atmosphere across the globe at all levels and the oceans now, and the better we observe that, and the more greater understanding we have of that, then the better our forecast can be. And certainly, you know, the growth of the use of satellite data and our improved skill in using that and the development mathematical techniques to bring that in has been fundamental, you know, one of the pillars of changing our forecast skill over time, along with the compute capability and the power of supercomputers to do with that. We're pushing our models harder and harder. We're trying to model smaller scales. We're trying to pick up, for example, you know, summertime convection and severe convection events that can lead to very heavy rainfall in a very localized area. And if you're unfortunately kind of in a catchment area where the rivers are going to respond very quickly to that flow, as we've seen in recent times, across the continent. Your ability to predict that and know how much rainfall's fallen, or initially predict whether it's going to rain and where it's going to be, and then to be able to observe the rainfall and then the intensity of the rainfall, and then put that into the models to understand what that means for flooding. We're talking about resolving sub-kilometer scale features, and that's really pushing the demands for observations. And whilst we have satellite data gives us great global coverage, you know, we still know there's a gap in our ability to observe those lowest parts of the atmosphere where the satellite data is seeing both the atmosphere and the surface properties and trying to pull apart that information. We still find challenging now. So I think, yes, as we grapple with how we help society, you know, thrive and cope with these severe weather events, putting big demands on our modelling capability, which then pushes the observations. I think the other important angle is, yes, all these observations are used for in the models, but they're also really important for operational meteorologists, people who are looking at the data coming in and providing real-time guidance and supporting customers and users right at the front, very often embedded with our customers, helping them understand maybe it's the evolving impact of thunderstorms over some significant airport or whatever. So the observations are really important for them, and the timely access and easy access to those observations is fundamental.
Absolutely. The question about the level of detail of the information is needed. I think in the recent past, when I was working in the research sector of the United Nations, there was this project on improving weather information for operations at the airport level. No, and this is where they have a lot of management problems on how they deal with landed airplanes. They have to manage really the traffic for airplanes that they are moving into the airport area. And the information they were looking were around 100 meters, 200 meters in terms of precipitation, wind, and all other information they need. This is a level where, of course, the airport like Hong Kong or Charles de Gaulle, Montreal, I mean, Johannesburg, they were the few airports working all together in this project. They were really looking to which type of information they can get from the existing observational system, which means satellite, but they were looking also which type of observation they can install and use. And I think this is a question probably for the future on this mismatch between a very high resolution information in certain areas or for specific applications like airports or urban area, and the level of information that we can get from, for instance, satellites. So there is probably a gap between these two, where we need to fill somehow, and traditional fluid dynamics modeling that are used nowadays, they've been relevant to understand processes, but I'm not sure that in the future they will be the main operational solutions. But I think that is a gap where I see important things to be developed in the near future.
Yeah, I think we recognize that as well. I mean, we know that there's increasing populations in the urban environment. It's a very difficult environment to observe. It's our traditional way of making observations in the urban. Well, our traditional way of making surface meteorological observations would be to have a nice enclosure with a grass surface and a Stevenson screen with our instruments 1.2 meters above the surface and complying with these really necessary kind of standards in terms of exposure and quality of the data, which is really important for our climate record. But in the urban environment, the people wandering around in the urban environment are walking on pavements surrounded by concrete buildings with some trees and things like that. And therefore, to make our forecasts relevant to them, to help them help us predict, what the temperature is going to be in that concrete tarmac grass mixed environment, is challenging. And trying to do that, say, with a traditional fluid mechanics model, representing the flow around every single building, it's hugely expensive. So I think what we're looking at is how we can use artificial intelligence to take the kind of the larger scale, 1 kilometer scale forecasting you get from a weather prediction model, And then downscale that to what that means for the temperature or the air quality in the urban environment. And the way we're looking at supplementing our core high quality observing systems in the ground is to use citizen science data and we have people who connect their personal weather stations to our what we call a WOW platform, weather on the web. And we bring in millions and millions of observations from citizen scientists on a daily basis, every month. But the quality of those is very different. And therefore, we have to have advanced techniques to look at quality control from those. And then also looking at advanced techniques using artificial intelligence that will link what the driving meteorology we get from our forecast means at the street scale. And I think that's a major change in how we will address those kind of forecast challenges in the future, both in terms of training those systems using a range of different observations, some very high quality observations, other not so high quality, but free and high density, or relatively free. I think it's what artificial intelligence is allowing us to do is to push the boundaries and use a wider range of observations.
It's quite amazing, Jonathan, if you think for a second. I mean, we are now speaking about how machine learning or artificial intelligence can solve or try to fill this gap between the very local meter scale and what is at the moment the measurement scale. Just to remind the people following this podcast, at the moment we have satellites that for meteorological parameters, they can go down to 500 meters. Now we have infrared channels at that resolution or visible channels. And it's quite amazing that now we are discussing how do we fill this gap with machine learning, while 3-4 years ago, we didn't even see coming this as a completely revolutionary element in our landscape. So we have nowadays operational AI system at the ECNWF Center, but also becoming operational in several meteorological services in Europe. We have AI models that are predicting in a very good way and good quality weather for the next 3-4 days and 10 days at the global scale. And now we are just focusing on this local to regional scale, how to fill. I think I found quite amazing, no, that we already absorbed this revolution and we consider as a fact, no?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's important to remember that these AI forecast systems, these global forecast systems, they're still developing, and they're developing an incredibly fast rate in terms of their skill, but we know they still have challenges. We don't know how good they are at operating at the kilometer or the sub-kilometer scale. How good are they at dealing with forecasting thunderstorms and small-scale kind of meteorological phenomena? So there's a huge amount to be done in that space, and I think the next step that we see is looking beyond there are a set of standard metrics we use to compare forecast models. You know, WMO agreed standard metrics, but they are things like 500 millibar pressure or the wind speed at 250 millibars height in the atmosphere, which are really important. But you know, what's really important for the users is, you know, how much it's raining, what the temperature is like at the surface. Are you picking out this small, low probability event, but with a high impact that over time suddenly becomes more and more likely, and are you on the ability of these systems to pick out what we might call these rare events but that have the biggest impact? So there's a huge amount to be done there, and particularly how will these models and how can these models work at the convective scale when we start getting down to the kilometer scale and being able to identify and deal with individual significant thunderstorm events and things like that.
Yeah, I think usually there are two questions when the people they start thinking about this machine learning and this development. And I think one is, on one side, I mean, if you want, there's people, they are still skeptically looking to the problem because they don't see the physics behind. No, we are using our word. I mean, we are both from a physics education background. We have been working with equations and try to understand how fluids work into the atmosphere, into the ocean. And then you move to a world where you don't deal on your hand directly with this equation, but you are giving a lot of observation to complex neural network with a lot probably of capable to capture non-linearities across the observations. And the people, they are, I think, a bit reluctant times to times. I think to me, the quest, we still know the equation. So the fact that we don't use the equation into the machine learning system doesn't mean that we don't know the equations or we don't know the physics behind. We know the turbulence, how the turbulence actually can act on the first 1-2 kilometers of the atmosphere, where we call it boundary layer. But we know how wind and pressure or wind and temperature are related. We know how turbulence works on the free atmosphere. And I think that knowledge is still with us. We just need to use to interpret how those models, they are connecting. And this is probably the challenging part. And this, on the other side, this machine learning is giving us the possibility to open the door to use what we call non-conventional data. People maybe today now listening the podcast, driving in a car now, especially in a new cars, it's probably more sensors than any other place than your house. Probably you have more sensors in your car. Of course, sensor for the distance, but also sensors for the rain or for the temperature and so forth. So you have a lot of informations that are usually difficult to use because they are in a street and you don't have a proper framework how to use. But the flexibility of machine learning gives us is to maybe try to use and absorb those information as well. I see these two, let's say, two sides of this world that are very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think, turning to first to your first point, I mean, that understanding of the physics is really important. One of the key elements, I think, of this AI world is how we reward the model. The choice of the mathematics that we use, we're always looking at get these models to solve the atmosphere in the best way, but that requires an understanding of how to reward them, what to reward the right things. So that detailed understanding of the physics is important there. And then, yes, I mean, if you consider your modern car, and as we move to more and more autonomy in vehicles, if you look at a collision avoidance radar on a car, and several, quite often some modern cars may have 4 radar systems, looking around and warning about nearby collisions. And we know that those radar systems are sensitive to rainfall. So, hey, hang on a minute, we've got all these cars driving around, potentially measuring a rainfall immediately in front of them. But they're also, because they're sensitive to the rainfall, they're also sensitive to the spray from the vehicle in front. And then they're also sensitive to, a film of water on the front of the car that you're driving and a film of water on the front of the car that's the head. And so when you sit and think, right, okay, in our traditional physical model, we need to have a solving equation here. We need to have an equation that represents what that radar is seeing as a function of the rainfall, the surface, the road type, the amount of spray, all this kind of stuff. It's really, really complicated and, very, very challenging to use that data. But from our understanding of how AI systems are working and their ability to extract information from a complex source of data, then in theory, if you can expose to an AI model the weather radar data, the truth about where it's raining, and enough of that data along with the collision avoidance radar data from cars, assuming you can get it from the cars onto the roadside systems and then back into the Met Office, if you can train your AI systems with that data, it will learn whether there is a link between the performance of the radar system and the amount of rainfall between one car and the next. And therefore, it would be able to help you extract that meteorological information. And that's, I think, where there's the real opportunity to suddenly have access to observations that we could never have dreamt of using in the future. But the big challenge is getting the training data, getting the observations in the right form, learning how to reward these AI systems for making the right decisions. And then, of course, it offers big challenges for us as an operational meteorological service in terms of how do we gain access to this data. There's cost issues there. But the volumes of data, if you think of, you look forward to 15 years from now, 20 years from now, where there's maybe a lot more and more autonomous vehicles and, 6G, whatever, 7G, 8G, whatever the communications technology is at that time frame, How do we get that volume of data from those cars to the roadside, back to our computers to feed these intensive systems? That's where there's going to be huge, huge challenges. And we need to do that so quickly because, you know, in meteorology, we know an observation that's an hour late nowadays is things moved on. That storm has moved on. You know, it's now impacting somebody else. We need access to these observations within minutes, 10 minutes or so. And then we need to get them into a forecast model and generate a new forecast really quickly. And the AI is helping us do that as well.
In 20 years, you said, I think this is what we are now building, no? We start launching the satellites that have been conceived 20 years ago. Now, one of the big, activities at the moment at HumanSat is to build this crystal ball. We call it foresight.
Yeah.
Is our foresight, is a crystal ball. We try to say, okay, what autonomous car will need in 15, 10, 15 years from now? And what does it mean to, in terms of observations and combination of observations we can have? How aviation will evolve and what does it mean for satellite observations? I think this is what we call our crystal ball, which is a bit virtual, but is built on expertise of people like Jonathan and other people around our community from Met Services and research institutions and other institutions working with us. I think this is the first step. But as you said, what is critical to us is to understand how Met Services, which are, say, the front end with all the need a society and a very complex society. I think it's I just like to quote Louis Uccellini, the former head of the weather services in NOAA in US. He was usually saying, we moved from predicting precipitation. Now the people, they want we predict quality of water the moment it lands on the land. I think this gives us an idea of how far we need to go. And in this perspective, the lenses, so how a Met Service is capable to interpret and to move ahead, it's extremely important. And so how UK Met Office is looking to this evolution of observations and how to integrate observations at the national level, it's one area where we are extremely interested to know what's happening in the next few years.
So I think for us, our big push is going to be learning how we can use AI modeling to allow us to bring a wealth of observations together and get a, you know, what we call, in the trade we call nowcasting. It's basically a short-range forecast between the here and now through to 6, 7, 8 hours ahead. Because increasingly, industry, government, you know, power generators, airports, they can deal with rapid updates of weather. They can use that information and make real changes to their systems and their operations. Whilst we continue to push for find a resolution, we have to remember that our customers have to be able to use that information as well, and they are, and AI is helping them use that information. So all these things are coming together. So I think our approach that we've decided to really start exploring is how can we use AI systems to bring together a very wide range of observations to really get a high resolution and high spatial and temporal resolution picture of the evolving weather around the UK. So it's early days in that. We're hoping to bring in, you know, our conventional observations that we've had for some time, but also things like our weather radar data. There is a huge volume of data there. We have, you know, three-dimensional pictures of the reflectivity. So that's how much radar energy has been reflected by individual raindrops and wind, Doppler wind data from the radar systems. So there's a huge wealth of data that we've struggled to be able to bring all of that data into our models because the volume is so high. But we're hoping that AI will allow us to kind of exploit that technology even further. We hope to bring in crowdsourced data. So this is citizen science data that fills in some gaps. And then, of course, ultimately, you know, you talked about the high spectral resolution sounder on meters out third generation. You know, that has the potential to provide some huge, huge volumes of data and huge insight into the development of severe convection and things like that. So we want to be able to bring that into that AI framework as well. So I think it's really exciting times to really push the boundaries of the spatial and temporal scales that we can model. But it's very, very challenging. We're talking about very large volumes of data. The requirement to go back and look at our archives of data that we have and get them in a form that are suitable for training AI systems. And then the ability for us to bring, when we go operational with that kind of system, and if it works, and we'll learn a lot over the coming few years as we start experimenting in this area. But it poses big challenges in getting all of that data, the new observations into the system, bringing them all into the Met Office and exposing them to our AI forecast systems. So, I think it's really exciting times, but it's not straightforward. I mean, the effort in trying to pull together multiple years of training data all in the same format and helping the AI system understand we feel a high quality and which data we have feel a lower quality. We have to get that right as well. We have to help the AI system understand that, you know, these sensors are very high quality, we have very high confidence in them. These we have less confidence, but there are many more of them and they fill up the gaps. It's a really big task, but I think it's hugely exciting and will help us, offers the opportunity to really provide some much better high resolution forecasts. I think the other interesting feature with these AI systems is that we believe that they will help us understand what the optimum observing system is. They'll help us understand what is the best blend of different types of observations and what density and what precision of observations we need. As we get more advanced AI systems that help us interpret what they're thinking and what they're doing, and I'm talking as though they're human here. as these AI systems, interpretive AI that allows us to understand what's going on within the system, then that will provide insight. And also, because these AI systems run very fast, we can look at how the forecast improves with different types of sensors. And we can explore that complexity of the system and say, well, if we were to put up, for example, this new satellite, and it measured the atmosphere at these wavelengths, at this precision, at this repeat time, what would be the impact of that data? But if we did this and we had a different combination of satellites and a different set of orbits and a different set of wavelengths and quality of data, we would get a different answer. And it'll be able to allow us to explore that observation space and optimize our systems for the future, and at a scale that we've never been able to achieve in the past.
That's probably the role we are trying to play with this foresight, with our crystal ball, to try to understand how far and how fast this is evolving, because we have seen in the case of ECMWF 3 years ago was on the research mode, and after 2 years it became operational and was a new technology. I think this is incredible, no? How the assimilation of a new technology and how fast has been used and then becoming operational. It's a very interesting case, and probably economists will study this in the future, I'm sure, together with other examples. And how this foresight will give us this information is extremely important to us at the moment, because it will help to understand what are the possible different scenarios and how we can better provide a new satellite design for future needs of a society with an increasing complexity as the European ones. Not only Europe, of course, we are looking also to the international value of this data for other society and also for developing countries. So that still remain one of our objective in the community, to help also countries they need the most. But I think for the European society, this will be extremely important, this type of interactions between EUMETSAT and Met Services, that they are discussing, developing new ideas, and this is really a very interesting moment. And I think I'm looking now to the video, and both of us, we are from a generation that will soon move to other activities, but there are young people in our organizations that I think it's for them also an exciting moment. And I also think to young people that they are interested nowadays to look to this AI evolution, look how AI can transform existing value chains or existing enterprises like the weather one. And I can tell you that it's extremely exciting to start working on this into the weather enterprise now, because it's very transformative and it will be very useful for society. So I think it's also a message to young people to be attracted to what the weather enterprise does.
Yeah, I agree entirely. I think it's always been an interesting topic. I mean, you and I have lived through huge changes. And one of the reasons I love the job is it has real impact on people. It makes a difference to people's lives. But I think we're on the cusp of something really big here. You know, for me, there's three things happening at the same time. We've got the growth of AI. Then we've got the growth of the Internet of Things, the increased connectivity of systems. That means that the sensitivity of our customers to the weather is increasing, but also our ability to bring in volumes and complexity of data together is unmatched to what has been in the past. And then the other thing is that we're seeing is the evolution of new observations, the private sector making observations, whether it's in space or ground or drones, all these kind of things. So there's these three factors are all coming together. They're all helping. They're all supporting each other. You know, the AI is helping us use these novel types of observations. The Internet of Things is allowing us to gain access to data. So these three things have really come together in the last few years, really, the last 5 years. And yeah, I think it's going to be transformational over the next 5 or 10 years in terms of the importance of observations. I think it's just growing and growing. And that poses challenges because access to observations has always impacted forecast scale, I think, in the future. Your ability to gather observations, interpret them, do quality control, and use them in an effective way will be a real discriminator in terms of your ability to get accurate forecasts. And that will pose challenges. It will be a competitive space to gain access to these observations. And that will be a challenge to the global community.
We can leave our podcast listener to this challenge. And thanks, Jonathan. I think those three key challenges are a good way to end our podcast today. And I think stay tuned, because I think this will come back and we will have, I'm sure, new surprises the next podcast even.
Yeah, that's great. And it's been an absolute pleasure as usual talking this way. So thank you very much for giving me the opportunity.
Yeah, thanks, John.
Thanks a lot, Jonathan.
Great. Thank you very much.
Ciao.
Yeah.
Ciao, ciao.
See you around. Cheers. Bye.
This was now the last podcast of the 2025 season of Forecasting Innovation. I'd like to thank all our guests for sharing their insights and all our listeners for being with us. Every conversation reminded and inspired us that curiosity and collaboration, science and technology drive progress and continue to shape the future of satellite operations, weather and climate services.